Okay, let's hit the second half of the lecture. So, we've got this situation. I'm just going through the last slide again. That we've got this deterministic system, far from equilibrium, clearly not behaving like conventional theory. So why do economists continue believing it? Well, the original belief, as you know, involves extreme assumptions. A common curate of interest, everybody able to borrow at the same rate, people having exactly the same expectations about the future. And one thing that wasn't said by Sharpe in that paper was being correct about their expectations as well. It's not only were you in agreement, you actually knew what the future was going to be. And he justified it on the basis of methodology and said that they're unrealistic and highly restrictive assumptions, but they're necessary to get the result of the theory, and the theory is nice because it matches what we already believe, which is a rather weird way to justify a theory. Now, Fanner came along in 1969 and accepting all that stuff in a way that I think is a sign of, well, madness, proved that even with those obscene assumptions, it still seemed to work. So in 69, when he was pretty much doing his PhD, I think, he put forward this argument and said that the model seems to be not only just a good first approximation, so it sort of gets where the market is at any particular point of time, it's a good second approximation as well. It'll tell which way the market's going to go next. That's a pretty extreme statement in terms of how successful the model was. And reviewed the data up until 1966. But if you take a good look at the paper, and again, this is why I want you to read the original, so I'm putting you through the torture of getting you to read those papers and take notes. By the way, I've marked the first 2 weeks' worth so far. If you haven't got a mark for the first 2 weeks, it hasn't been submitted yet, tell me about it, okay? And I'll try to get up to the next 2 weeks by next week. But take a look at the data range there. It has three tables from 1957 to 66, from 46 to 66, and 55 to 64. And out of that, he constructed his time series on which he tested the data. Now let's embed that particular range that he used for his paper in the full range of information I've shown you that we can now get today from just downloading from Yahoo. And what you find is that over the period from 1915 to 1999, the index was frequently well above or well below that exponential fit. The fit's good, it's 0.9 r squared, but there's extreme movements away from it. Now, the data that he used was just that narrow range from 49 to 66. And you'll notice that that particular period is comparatively stable. It fits a steeper trend than the actual market fitted over the entire century. But there's not much volatility there. So his theory paper was published here, Sharpe's paper. And Fanner's empirical examination of the data just used that window. And it looks pretty good for that window of data. Now, of course, we've gone on beyond that, and clearly it's wrong, as I've shown you. We had the crash of 73, where the market fell 45% in 23 months. And then we had the crash of 1987. And when you take a look at where the market got to back in the late 90s, it was about 20 years ahead of its trend. So all that stuff was very, very different to the analysis that Sharpe and Fanner put forward. But it looks okay in that narrow range of data he worked with. So let's dive in a bit more deeply. Now here are the assumptions that Sharpe made. A common pure rate of interest. So you can borrow as much as you like. Or you'll assume the unlimited short selling, which is the same effect. And homogeneity of expectation, that wonderfully neutral, you know, almost positive word, agreeing about the future. And his defence was this theoretical one, that they're extreme assumptions, but they're necessary because the theory, then we can get out of that, then fits the beliefs we currently have about the nature of stock markets. Now, how valid is that defence in methodological terms? Well, you'll get conventional economists shoving that at you all the time. It comes from a paper by Milton Friedman, I think in 1953, called The Methodology of Positive Economics. Now, this predates when students started whinging about the course in lectures. That began in the 1960s and 70s. I know because I was one of the whingers. So you're not talking about your raving 1960s radicals at this stage. You're talking people back in the 1950s, and you're saying, don't object to our assumptions. Intriguing reason as to why. And he argued the realism doesn't matter. You can't assess the theory, he said, on the basis of its assumptions. And in fact, he put forward this paradoxical statement that the more significant a theory is, the more unrealistic its assumptions will appear to be. Because if it's a good hypothesis, it explains a lot using very little. And that's actually a persuasive argument for a lot of people. Now, that's the defence that Sharpe invoked. He said it's okay to assume that investors agree about the future, even if you know it's not true, so long as the resulting model fits the data. So that fudge was used to defend the theory. Now, in my History of Economic Thought course, I go into why that is a methodological argument. It's still a false argument, because what it's pretty much saying is, I can assume that your car accelerates because there are chipmunks in the wheel, and when you put the accelerator on, you're squeezing their tail and they run faster, and therefore the wheels turn. I could use that as a theory of how your car travels, and that'd be quite an acceptable theory according to this approach. It's instrumental. Okay? And I fitted it to the data. I had, you know, enough chipmunks inside there and squealing hard enough and the pinch on their tails being hard enough, I could give you an explanation for how fast your car accelerates. Now, for a start, I'm going to get to the reason why that's nonsense in a moment. But one thing I did with you last week is show you can challenge assumptions on whether they're logically consistent with each other. So I showed you last week that you can prove by contradiction that the square root of 2 is not a rational number. Okay? Well, equally, I think you can prove by contradiction that if you need to presume to get the market efficiency outcome, that all investors have exactly the same expectations and all can borrow at the same rate of interest, you're proving that you don't have a capital asset market line. They're inconsistent assumptions. You cannot have a multiple market where everybody's the same. It's nonsense. If that's what you need to get the result, then you've shown you can't get the result. It's proof by contradiction again. And also, back to the chipmunks, sciences do attempt to build theories that actually explain what's happening in reality. So if you try to put the chipmunk theory of your accelerator forward in an engineering class, you'd be laughed out and locked up in the process. They want you to explain what's actually happening. They want a causal explanation. So models in science aren't just instrumental. They're supposed to in some way capture the essential behaviour of the system. And what economists call assumptions, they would call the structure of the model. Very, very different thing. But Miles Musgrave, working along with this argument that Friedman made about things you can ignore, assumptions you leave out, he said, well, you can classify them in three ways. There's negligibility assumptions. When you say I'm going to assume something, like, for example, I assume when I drop 2 stones from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, I'm assuming there's no atmosphere out there. Obviously there is. What I'm really saying is ignoring the impact of the atmosphere and slowing down how fast 2 lead balls of different weights fall out of the tower will not affect the results of my experiment. That's a negligibility assumption. A domain assumption comes back to assuming there's no air around again. So I'm assuming I can walk outside on the moon and I assume there's atmosphere. How long am I going to last? About 30 seconds? That's a domain assumption. Okay? You want to be very sure when you assume that there is atmosphere and therefore you can walk outside and breathe without a space helmet, that you're actually on a planet with a decent atmosphere. Has anybody seen Avatar yet? Anybody not seen Avatar? Worth seeing. Good movie, I think. Fun movie anyway. Then there are what are called heuristic assumptions, and that's something that's slightly more complicated. So I'll give you an example of that shortly on. Now, negligibility says something doesn't matter. And if you're doing the experiment of dropping the 2 lead weights out of the Leaning Tower of Pisa to show that a heavy weight moves no faster than the light one as it falls towards Earth under the influence of gravity, that's a negligibility assumption. You can get away with it. In fact, there's reasons just to work out that the lighter ball, the smaller ball, would fall faster, less wind resistance, I think. So you can assume that that's negligible and you can get a decent experiment. Now, a domain assumption is like the one I said about I assume I can take off my space helmet when I walk out onto the planet. If that's true, then you survive. If it's wrong, you die. There's a fairly big difference between the two. It's a domain. If the assumption is correct, the theory works. If the assumption is not correct, the theory is a failure. It cannot be applied at all. So a more technical version of this is Newton's explanation of planetary motion. Because Newton's equations of gravity and motion assume that the planet there's only one planet orbiting a sun. And he then proved that the orbit of that planet would be elliptical, which is roughly speaking what we see is the orbit of the planets around the Sun now. Now, as it happens, if there's more than one planet, the fact that they appear elliptical, and they are roughly elliptical, is a bit of a fluke, because once you get beyond one planet, there is no solution. And in fact, the paths they can follow can be any path at all under the influence of the Sun's gravity and their own interacting gravities. And therefore, if you have a multiplanetary system, there'll be collisions. Now, that sounds strange when you look at the stable solar system we're in now. I highly recommend, if you get a chance to go and see it, go and see Hubble 3D, because they then show you what is really shown in those fantastic photographs you see, just tiny extracts in the newspapers. And one of the explorations they take you is seeing this distant cluster of suns where there's a large number of suns being formed in some particular part of the galaxy, and then zoom in and show you an actual planetary system like the Earth evolving. And you've got this dark rim of dirt around a sun where that dust is clearly going to aggregate into planets. But to actually form the planets, there are collisions. And we know that's the case for Earth now, because the reason we have that core I mentioned earlier in the lecture is because two massive planetoids collided to form the Earth, and the ejectile result of the collision was the Moon. The Moon lacks a core. The Earth has a bigger core than planets of the actual same size should have if they formed on their own. And that's a large part of why life is on this planet, because that core gives us radiation, which generates a magnetic belt that actually deflects a lot of the solar radiation, which would otherwise kill life on the planet. So this is a seriously important theory, and we're going from a negligibility assumption. No, it's not. It's a domain assumption. If in a multiplanetary system, then there will be collisions, and therefore the nature of the system is entirely different. It's not a negligibility assumption anymore. It's a domain assumption. And it gives us a much richer explanation for how the planetary system evolved and how it functions. Now, the final one is this heuristic assumption. And that is something you know is false. You've seen something you know is false, but it's a stepping stone to a more elaborate and more correct theory. And Einstein gives a wonderful example of this in a very readable book he published, which is literally titled Relativity, a Simple Introduction That Any Intelligent Person Can Understand. You don't want to try to read his complicated book. I tried, I couldn't do it. But the simple one is quite unintelligible, as he said. It's very well explained. And he said, let's assume that you can work out how fast somebody's walking across in the aggregate when they're walking across a train carriage by adding up the forward motion of the train and the sideways motion of the person walking from one side of the carriage to the other. So you've got, there's the forward motion of the train. Imagine we have a spaceship travelling at 9/10 the speed of light. There's the sideways motion of the person walking across the carriage. Imagine the spaceship fires some projectile at 9/10 the speed of light sideways. Now, we know that in the left-hand case, you're pretty damn accurate if you use the triangulation of the two to work out the actual speed of the person walking across the train. But when you add up the other side, you are not going to get that the projectile is travelling at more than one times the speed of light. Okay? So what Einstein says is we've made an assumption that can't be maintained. In other words, the law I've written down does not hold in reality. For the time being, however, we assume its correctness. Then what he does is show how you have to modify that rule, and that's what led to the special theory of relativity. So that's the way you should use a heuristic assumption. So what about our mate Sharp? We assume all investors have identical accurate expectations for the future. They all have identical access to limitless credit. Negligible, domain, or heuristic? Well, it isn't negligible, and the best authority for that is Sharp himself in that later paper I showed you from 1970, where he says, if you drop them, the theory's in a shambles. That's not negligible. That's when somebody walks out on the planet and takes off their space helmet and suffocates in the air. Heuristic? Well, it could have been. One of the students in the evening class said, well, couldn't you actually assume that to begin with and then modify it? That would have been potentially a way to reach a more general theory, which would be quite interesting. That wasn't what was done. They stuck with that raw version and never went on to another set of assumptions. They could have replaced risk with uncertainty, for example, or they could have taken account of people having different expectations and therefore necessarily having inaccurate expectations, different access to credit. That could have been done. It wasn't. So that really is the basis of why the CAPM has failed as a model. And the person who's admitted it's failed is one of the people who you probably had a lot of reading from has said it works, which is famine. Now, the initial evidence, as I said, does seem to favour it. You get the idea that prices of shares accurately reflect current reflect future earnings, that there's shares that are highly volatile, give a higher return, and they're more correlated with the movements in the economy in general, and that investors are choosing just on a risk-return trade-off because there's no point in trying to time the market and so on. And the initial research did find that positive relationship between return and the degree of volatility. But there's a good argument they're a fluke. Let's take a good look at that data series again. So again, with the paper done, published in 64 by Sharp, FAMA's research done in 66, what you had was this period of steady advance between 1949 and 1966, steady advance at quite a high rate, a 467% increase over 17 years. And that kept on happening for another 2 years later, which is pretty much the period that FAMA used to do the empirical evaluation. Then you had about 15 years of stagnant stock prices. So right from the outset, they were starting to defend the theory because the data after the theory is written was no longer as supportive as the data beforehand. Now, here's the enthusiastic stuff that FAMA put forward. And he says, with few exceptions, the model stands up well. He said, the assumptions are unrealistic, but who cares? So glossing over that methodological issue, which I think is a sign of a bad theory. And says that in the result, it's good not just for picking the market, but even its rate of change. It's a great model. And there's no evidence against it, etc., etc. But he did admit to one anomaly, and I'm going to highlight this now because this is important in terms of looking at the chaos theory and fractal interpretation instead. And that's admitted that if there was a large movement one day, it tended to be followed by a large movement another day, shortly afterwards, but there was no particular pattern to the pluses and minuses. Now his argument was, well, that means they cancel each other out. The reality is that's a sign of a fractal distribution. And that's what Bernie Mandelbrot was trying to get into the literature at the same time as FAMA's paper, and its dominance of the literature was keeping Bernie Mandelbrot's work out of circulation. So he did spot that large daily price changes are followed by other ones, but they're random, looks like a denial of the random walk, but he said since they're random in sign, we can pretty much ignore them. Now that's entirely the wrong way to interpret that data, but it's understandable from the perspective that FAMA came to it from, which is fairly conventional linear statistics. Now, look at the range of data considered, 50 to 90, 50, 66. That's the Dow Jones over that 16-year period. That's the Dow Jones over the longer period. Now, of course, there's some exponential trends inside. They're actually taking a log to really show you. But you can see this by looking at the data in 2000 to 2010. There's something substantially different about the long-term pattern to the short-term. Let's drill down a bit further. Here are the daily movements in 50 to 66. And that's really what FAMA was looking at. These are the daily movements over the entire time period. Bit different, aren't they? Now, there's the range that FAMA looked at. And if you used a random distribution argument and an argument that it was, plus or minus five standard deviations was all you need to worry about, looks pretty good because there aren't many points that exceed that 5% range, which is less than 5 standard deviations, but close enough. But you look at the actual data instead, you get a very, very different story. So here's what I've done here is I've superimposed that artificial time series I showed you earlier over the 50 to 66 data. And you can see it pretty much blots the whole thing out. There's a few little points where the actual data is more extreme, but it's pretty okay to ignore it. Here's the same exercise for 1914 to 2009. And I think you ignore those differences between the simulated series and the actual at your peril. There's a huge gap between the two. And they're clustered in several locations. Now there's 50 to 66. Again, it was a safe time in the market. That's exactly the same data. So it seems like it's safe. No, it's not. So it's okay for 50 to 66. You can ignore the few anomalies there. It's disastrous over the entire time period of the series. that's far too many outliers and far too much clustering of them. And then, of course, you've seen the profession dominated by trying to explain those while sticking within the same paradigm for the last 40 or 50 years. So again, here's the daily movements. For 50 to 66, you've got a bit of a gap. There are quite a few events which are more extreme, but not enough to worry about in a crucial way. Let's filter them out. Here's the same story going over the entire time period. So here I'm actually, this is going out to 10 standard deviations, or 10% movements. This is going out to 30 standard deviations, so a much larger range. You can see that there's 400 events there that are outside the range predicted by the random distribution argument, versus less than 100 there. The range that I'm looking over here is gigantic, 22.6% fall in one day. Yeah?
Is there any evidence to suggest that the advent of computerized trading and EAs and automated trading and all that markets are more volatile in the past 10 to 15 years?
I think that's probably feasible, but it's also the sheer level of valuation that got to as well. So if you actually take a look at the... If you deflate this information using the price-to-earnings ratio... That's what's been done. If you want to find some good data on this, go and take a look at Robert Schiller's homepage, and he has a downloadable Excel spreadsheet there which gives you the 10-year lagged price-to-earnings ratio. So it's taking the previous 10 years' earnings on the S&P and dividing that by the price, dividing it into the current price of the S&P, and that therefore filters out, you know, ephemeral companies like ABC and long-term capital management and Bond and Skase and so on. These are the actual earnings, and you see a huge spike in 29 and a huge spike in 87 and a much, much bigger one in 2000. But those are the periods of volatility. So you can't blame computers in 1929. Okay, so it is partly a story, but it's not the entire explanation. The down here we have is only a 6.5% range versus 22.6 in the full data series. So some outliers, but you can ignore them. Massive number of outliers and gigantic impact upon the market's final value as well in the full data series. And again, the same story. Simulate, look at the actual data changes, the one that's similar to the chart I showed you earlier. But look at the actual data changes versus the simulated for the 1950 to 66 period. Then you find the worst movement in the actual data is -6.5. That's more extreme than the simulated data, which is only going to give you 2.2. as a range, but that 2.2 value turns up as about the 20th value in the actual data. So you've just got to drop off about 19 observations, which in a period that long, that's not much, you know, bit of linear filtering, why not? But you leave out the important information. Try doing that with 1914 to 2009, and you have to leave out the top 100 movements plus, actually the top 400 movements, I think you'll find out. And the simulated data is nowhere near as extreme as the actual data. So the worst on the simulated data is -4.2. There's no overlap between the simulated data and the actual data for the first 100 movements. And when you've got 100 movements where they range between 4.5 standard deviations and 22 standard deviations, or well, percentage movements, that's a big difference. You're leaving out most of the information in the market if you leave out those 100 points. So I think the early success of CAPM was a statistical aberration. The period used was too short, just 16 years, when you could have used 60 years' worth of data, and too stable. It was a period when the debt levels were low, when the financial system was quite robust, and where the degree of speculation was much lower than it is now, and much lower than it was back in the 1920s as well. So he chose a period that Minsky would call a period of financial tranquility, and then thought that was the normal state for the market. And look where we are today, thanks to that. Now, Fama, of all people, and I'm sure you're still getting his stuff being put forward supporting the efficient markets hypothesis and other courses and textbooks, he admitted the defeat of the theory in 2004. That hasn't stopped him continuing to try to believe in it, when you see him being interviewed these days still. But in this paper, in the Journal of Economic Literature, which is one of the two, it's a companion journal to the American Economic Review, he said that it must be rejected on the data alone. And I think it should have been rejected on the basis of methodology to begin with. But here's Fama talking about it in 2004. This is one of the readings in the course. It's one I recommend you all read. Some of you will get it given as a random one for this week's readings, but you should all take a good look at it, because FAM has been so much a part of enforcing belief in the efficient markets hypothesis, and is still being quoted by textbooks today for the before this paper. This paper is crucial for saying you shouldn't take what people tell you FAMer believes seriously, because this is what he was forced to believe by the data. So he said, it's intuitively pleasing predictions. Unfortunately, the empirical record is poor enough to invalidate the way it's used in applications, back to your question about hedge funds using this information. He said, what's the reason why that might happen? They may reflect too many simplifying assumptions. All of a sudden, the methodological stuff he glossed over, he's now saying we should take it seriously. But he said, whatever it is, we should not use the model. Using an empirical basis will be invalid. And here's his explanations as to why. Now, he admits, for a start, the assumptions are madness. But the one thing I like about this, one of the many things I like about this paper, is he adds one more crucial detail here about those assumptions. Not only are you assuming people agree about the returns, this distribution is the true one. That's another way of saying what people's expectations are about the future are correct. Now, you don't see that sort of stuff written up in the textbooks, because I can't think of any students gullible enough to believe that. So the way it's packaged is to say people don't make mistakes. Okay? You don't make mistakes about the future. That sounds sensible to you? I'd like to come back in 30 years' time and tell me all the mistakes you haven't made in the intervening 30 years. It's nonsense to make that sort of argument. But the essential thing is the model assumes the investors know the future. And if you can find, that is a domain assumption. If you can find a planet on which the people can know the future, then the model will work.
If everybody knows the future, I don't understand why someone is selling while the other one is buying. So everybody should buy or everybody should sell.
Exactly. In fact, that's one paper, when I first started having to read this stuff, when I started lecturing in finance, I found a paper by Hal Varian, who's another one of the people who's drawn a lot of neoclassical thought forward. And I was reading the paper and thinking, it's inevitably reaching the point where he's going to say the actual volume of trades on the market is zero. I can't see how he's going to avoid reaching that conclusion. And he got to that point and said, obviously I've reached the conclusion that there should be no trades on the market, but we'll skip that over and keep on going with the rest of the paper. Quite literally, I've got to see if I can find the paper again. It's a hilarious read. I've got a strange sense of humour. This economist is strange, so you've got to laugh at them. There's a cartoon I think I've shown you, which has two guys in white suits, and there's a whole bunch of equations on one side of the board and a whole bunch of equations on the other side of the board. In the middle, there's a statement saying, and here a miracle happens. Well, that was literally how you could describe Hal Varian's paper, and for that matter, Sharpe and everybody else. Now, all these other reasons as well, if you can't even work out an efficient portfolio once you take into this account, when the assumptions are abolished, you can't have, the market portfolio itself won't be an efficient portfolio. So lots of reasons that it might fail. But he said, well, hopefully the data might save it. Unfortunately, no. Again, he comes back to the same thing. All interesting models involve unrealistic simplifications. Now, that's a bastardization of good methodology. Again, economists are notorious for doing that. But, of course, he wasn't lucky. 40 years of data after the original paper strongly contradicted every last version of CAPM. Returns weren't related to betas. Other variables did matter. And when you did a linear regression on the data, you got a very different fit out of the data than you got out of the model. So I'll take you through those. Again, I say it's worth reading the whole paper. So they tested three implications: that expected returns are linear related to betas and no other variable has any explanatory power, that the beta premium is positive, so the more volatility, the higher the return, and that assets which are uncorrelated will return the risk-free rate, and the beta premium gives you the expected market return minus the risk-free rate. So he found, yes, there is a positive relationship when you look at all shares and you don't actually disaggregate them or in any particular way. You find there is a relationship, but it's too flat. So the intercept of is the risk-free rate, and the coefficient is the beta, but the regressions find that you got a too high valuation for the risk-free rate and too low a slope for the beta compared to what the theory says will happen. This is the chart that shows that. And there's the straight line is the prediction the model gives you, about what the risk rate will be, which is a bit below 8%, and the slope of that line, which is quite steep, and you can see the actual data. If you did a regression there, you get a risk rate of about 11% and far less return in terms of increased return for taking on the higher volatility. So, as Fama summarised, the predicted return of the portfolio with the lowest beta is 8.3%. It's actually about 11. And the predicted return on the highest volatility is actually is about 17-18%, and the actual return is about 14%. So you're not rewarded for taking on volatility. Whereas the theory argues you will be. Then the argument that beta's completely explained returns can be deconstructed by saying, well, let's take a look at something else, some other way of characterising the market information, such as, for example, book-to-market returns, and then see what happens when we rearrange the data from highest to lowest book-to-market valuations. Okay, the higher the book ratio, the more the share is undervalued in the sense that people like Warren Buffett would focus on. And they found, Fama and French, quoting themselves, found 14 years earlier, that size, earnings to price, debt to equity, and book to market ratios all matter. They all tell you something that you don't get out of the beta alone. And I think the best example is using that book to market ratio, because in fact, if you follow those, you'll do far better. That's what your accountants would tell you rather than what your finance professors would tell you. In this case, as many other cases, listen to the accountants, not the financial economists. Except for a few weirdos like myself. So here's the average relationship on book-to-market ratios increased in a nice linear way from 10.1% for the most overvalued to 16.7% for the most undervalued. And the beta relationship was the opposite of what was predicted. The portfolio with the lowest book-to-market ratio had the highest beta but the lowest return. So a more overvalued stock of one with a high beta is going to give you very, very bad returns. And here's the chart that shows that. Now there's you can see the straight line prediction from the model itself about what the returns would be like, and see where the data is. If you actually did a regression on that, you're going to get a line that's virtually orthogonal to the prediction of the theory. There's a huge gap between the theory's predictions and actual reality yet again. So the end result was that you shouldn't use the cap end. Notice this, I wish you'd actually written in there, despite what I wrote back in 56. The cap end has never been an empirical success. That contradicts his very first major paper. And of course you'll see, now he's actually deriding the textbook, which is good to see. At last, somebody on the inside attacking the textbooks. Finance texts recommend using the risk-related cap end to work out your cost of capital. But if you do that, you'll get too high costing. It'll discourage investment that should otherwise take place. So it's not even worth using as a guide for investment policy. And he says, we continue, he calls it a theoretical tour de force. I think it's a theoretical tour de failure. With something that stops at that point, we shouldn't be using it in the first place. You couldn't get past that first base of absurd assumptions like everybody agreeing or limitless borrowing, then you should have thrown the theory out and started all over again. But they themselves warn their students that despite its seductive simplicity, it shouldn't be used. Well, I wish that would filter through to the rest of the economics profession. It's still got a long, long way to go forward. So these are some of the various charts that just show how badly the theory fits reality. A couple I've showed you before of those. So the founding fathers of the discipline have actually rejected it. Back to my original question, why is it still being taught? Why do they still cling to it? Well, there's a lot of ideology to that, unconscious ideology. People aren't aware that they're ideological, I'm afraid to say. Often it's because many of the people who teach this stuff still don't know that the founding fathers have abandoned it. Economists don't read their own literature well enough, let alone literature outside their own profession, which is one reason why I'm so emphatic for you guys to read the literature. And since they don't know there's an alternative, even if they are aware that it's been abandoned, they continue teaching it because they don't know there's any other way to go about it. But there are alternatives. There's what's called the fractal markets hypothesis, another one called the coherent market hypothesis that Craig Ellis is better at than I am, and the inefficient market hypothesis. I'll take you through some of those next week. In economics, a key aspect of the capitalist pricing model was that it made it quite possible to neatly slice economics from finance. You do a course in economics and talk about investment and return and stuff like that. And in finance, you talk about book to market, or you talk about the capital markets and so on, and debt levels and the right level of debt and everything else, and they could be neatly separated. Now, that meant that finance doesn't affect economics if CAPM is correct. But of course, if CAPM is false, then finance does affect economics. So you have to have a combined theory of finance and economics. You can no longer separate the two. And that's something I'll go into next week. Anybody have a bit of a chat about all that stuff? We'll just shut down this. Which one?
This one is like impossible.
And that's one is impossible.
Yeah.
Okay,
what's
the easy one? Boy, I've tried to read it myself.
It's hard, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hang on a second. Hang on a second. This might be the one I have to read.
The beginning sounds easy, but once he starts getting...
And he gets into tensors, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's good. Honestly, anything you and I can handle.